I'm writing this right before the war begins. It's 10 p.m. I spoke too soon. It's 10:15, and here come the goons on a TV screen. Peace is doomed. At least it seems my coalition means the ends are never justified. Machiavelli lied. Can you justify the loss of innocent lies? Live from the Oval Office. Off with his heading for a coffin. Cause hard luck softens fears for chemical tea parties in Boston. But what about the go? We ain't felt one blow from this so-called war on terror. I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but bombs over Baghdad came true for Junior. Saddam wanted to debate, but we'd rather bomb sooner than discuss with our fellow men. Crude tactics from a yellow-bellied Texan. Flowing fountains of reason, so bump this track or call me out for treason. I believe what I believe in, and I believe in this country. If it weren't for some things worth fighting for, scoring 7 years of fear. But it's the potential that keeps me here, the land of opportunity, targets, foreign markets. Now my fellow citizens watch as civilians pay the price for freedom. The unbalanced axis of evil will lead them and bleed them down for the resources, which forces dependency on the U.S. presidency. Notes with quotes like, may God bless, we made this mess. Now let's clean up Iraq and find out who's next on the war of terrorism checklist. It's getting reckless, so change the name to Operation Iraqi Freedom as the media continues to feed them what's already been chewed. Like ABC, CNN, I see BS news. With every button I press clues, but no answers to reporters. Live on the Kuwaiti border, make no sense. Fucking journalists, primetime drama, bullshit. There's a fine line between ignorance and bliss. And yo, I see it, it makes me sick. So from this day forth and for eternity to come, conflict creates conflict with nowhere to run until the second coming of God's son. Remember, W is not one, even if you don't got one. Dollar, holler at your forefathers to redistribute power to all the people. The ruling system must reflect our decisions like prisms. While I spark the ism, America free. Is America free? Power to the people, power to me.
The people of the United States,
not in my name.
Thanks for returning to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program is The World is a Battlefield. Jeremy Scahill reveals covert operations unknown to the public and carried out across the globe by men who do not exist on paper and will never appear before Congress. Raising questions about freedom and democracy, war and justice, morality and politics. Terrence McNally is the interviewer, journalist, and radio host. And then later, the U.S. and China strike a climate deal.
I do want to talk just a second more about, so one can imagine how you become a reporter doing what you're doing, but writing best-selling books is another challenge. A, you shifted to investigative reporting from just trying to give a voice, but B, setting down to write this one is 500 pages, you know, plus, and Blackwater. When did you know you had the chops for that?
Well, you know, I had been working in radio, and then Democracy Now! Was shifting over to also being TV. And, you know, as much as I love Democracy Now!, I didn't want to be on, I don't want to be on TV as a reporter. I also was feeling like I wanted a challenge beyond radio. And one of the things I loved about radio is that you get to paint a picture that someone else will likely never see, and you have to rely on the power of sounds and your words. And the same is true for good writing. And I remember Naomi Klein is a good friend of mine who wrote, of course, The Shock Doctrine and No Logo, and is a, you know, rather famous person. But she's a very good friend of mine. And I told her, you know, this was in 2005. I said, I really think I want to try to make a run at writing. And Naomi said, look, I can talk to people at the Nation Institute, which is the nonprofit sort of sister institution of the Nation magazine, and try to get you a fellowship there. But she said, I'm just going to warn you, fellowship is a code word for getting paid a very small amount of money for a lot of work. So just if you, and I had, for the first time in my life, I finally had healthcare benefits. I was at Democracy Now! And I got healthcare. And then I'm like, well, I want to go and do writing. So then I leave the comfort of having a job in New York that was, you know, I was able to pay the rent. I had healthcare, and I take a $25,000 before taxes fellowship
with no
benefits, right? And I was just hoping that I didn't get, you know, hurt or something. And ended up starting a relationship with The Nation. And the first story that I did was to go down to New Orleans in the aftermath of the flooding of the city. And on my second day there, I met these guys from Blackwater patrolling the streets of New Orleans with M4 assault rifles, and some of them had just been, you know, deployed in Iraq or Afghanistan. And I traveled around with these guys and then started to ask questions like, how is it that we have armed security guys on the streets of a U.S. city who look like paramilitaries? Isn't this a kind of backdoor subversion of posse comitatus, which, you know, prohibits the military from engaging in law enforcement type activities? And who hired these guys? Well, that was really the first serious piece of investigative journalism that I did, and I found out that they had been hired on a no-bid contract by the Department of Homeland Security, and that they ended up making well over $70 million for their operations there, and they had people spread out from Texas through Louisiana to Alabama, and I discovered that the owner, you always have to ask who benefits, that the owner of that company, this guy, Eric Prince, was a major figure in the sort of radical religious right, and that his family had been some among the top fundraisers for the creation of what now are the staple organizations of the religious right, Focus on the Family, you know, and the Family Research Council. People like James Dobson and Gary Bauer got their seed money from Eric Prince's family to start their operations. And they really changed the nature of the Republican Party, that when the radical right, sort of religious right, started to kind of become the dominant player in Republican politics. It was really when a lot of the current policies, the mentality in our country right now, started to take hold. So for me, this was a story not just about one company, but about what was happening in Iraq with war profiteering and unaccountable mercenary forces. You know, they sort of came back and they created like a Baghdad on the bayou, you know, in the U.S. Gulf. They went from the Gulf, the Persian Gulf, to the U.S. Gulf. And I became obsessed with that company and learned how to do FOIA requests, Freedom of Information requests, started to, you know, go to Washington and try to get various congresspeople to go on the record, trying to find whistleblowers within the company. And I was, you know, learning as I went and ended up writing a series of articles. And Katrina Vandenhoevel, this is right at the beginning of my fellowship there, Katrina Vandenhoevel, the editor of The Nation, sat me down one day. I'll never forget it because it was like a sort of a transformational moment for me. And she said, look, we really love your work and we're very excited that you're doing it. But we are a small, poor weekly magazine. We can't publish an article every single week about the same private company. So you either need to like diversify your beat or write a book. And I had never thought of writing a book. And originally it was just going to be like a collection of the writings from Blackwater. But when I then gave myself the space to really dig into that company, I realized that this was a sort of epic moment in our history and that people need this information. And I just became very intent on exposing that company and ended up writing about 500-page book on Blackwater. And that's really how I learned investigative journalism. And I met a lot of guys. After the book came out, I would get approached at book events or get emails from guys who were in the Navy SEALs or Delta Force. And they would say, you know, look, I don't really care for your politics, but you're darn right about that company. And I started to meet people who became sources then. And when I would meet them in real life, they would realize that I wasn't the sort of this kind of clownish communist that they had imagined in their head. But not to say that communists are clowns, but they had a clownish, cartoonish version of who I am.
Who would write this sort of stuff?
Right. And then they would see me, you know, going after the Bush administration on, you know, Amy's show or on some MSNBC thing. But then, you know, I would meet them in real life and they would, you know, realize that I was very serious about trying to find the truth. And I got to know a lot of those guys and their sources now in this book.
In the new book, in the Dirty Wars book, sure.
Right, that was my gateway. You know, you were talking about the Joint Special Operations Command, which is called JSOC. You know, people say it like, you know, JSOC. My gateway into that story was from meeting people, that some of whom contacted me to tell me how horrible of a person I was. And I just would write them back and say, well, what, you know, why don't we talk about this? And I got to know these guys. Just yesterday, I flew from Santa Monica Airport to Catalina Island in an old Soviet Yak aircraft with the former senior SEAL sniper, Navy SEAL sniper of the Naval Special Warfare Group, a guy who I've become friends with named Brandon Webb. We have very different views on the world. I've learned a tremendous amount from getting to know him. And so to have stories of SEAL snipers in a book where you're also telling the stories of Afghan civilians or Yemenis who've had their villages blown up by U.S. cruise missiles is what I think is the power of the book. I tried to weave their stories in as one. But, you know, I think for a lot of people, the idea that someone like me would be, and he let me fly the plane too for a while, which is a little bit scary. You know, that I would be in a two-person plane with a former senior SEAL instructor who trained the snipers on SEAL Team 6 that ended up killing Osama bin Laden. you know, it's for me, that is, I'm doing exactly what I want to do, because I think that story of people like him is so important, but so too is the story of all of these civilians. And often the story of the civilians is what's left out. And so putting those two together was what I tried to do in the book, and have it read in some form like narrative, nonfiction, with characters
and
plots and twists and things.
So.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
He said, "Son, have you seen the world? Well, what would you say if I said that you could just carry this gun? You'll even get paid." I said, "That sounds pretty good." Black leather boots, spit shine so bright. They cut off my hair, but it looks alright. We marched and we sang, we all became friends as we learned how to fight. A hero of war, yeah, that's what I'll be. And when I come home, they'll be damn proud of me. I'll carry this flag to the grave if I must, 'cause it's a flag that I love and a flag that I trust. I kicked in the door, I yelled my commands. The children, they cried, but I got my man. We took him away, a bag over his face, from his family and his friends. They took off his clothes, they pissed in his hands. I told them to stop, but then I joined in. We beat him with guns and batons, not just once, but again and again. A hero of war, yeah, that's what I'll be. And when I come home, they'll be damn proud of me. I'll carry this flag to the grave if I must, 'cause it's a flag that I love and a flag that I trust. She walked through bullets and haze. I asked her to stop, I begged her to stay, but she pressed on. So I lifted my gun and I fired away. And the shells jumped through the smoke and into the sand that the blood now had soaked. She collapsed with a flag in her hand, a flag white as snow. A hero of war, is that what they see? Just medals and scars, so damn proud of me. And I brought home that flag, now it gathers dust, but it's a flag that I love, it's the only flag I trust. He said, "Son, have you seen the world? Well, what would you say if I said that you could?"
Very quickly, this thing that you're, this phenomenon you're describing in a way of people who say, "I disagree with your politics, disagree with your worldview, but you hit it off and you actually, How does that happen? What do you think it is? What do you think it is about you as a human being and them as a human being that this other stuff doesn't matter?
That's a challenging question. I mean, I try in my personal life not to be a jerk to anybody. I mean, it's just part of it. I mean, you know, most people aren't jerks, and I think a lot of us make a mistake of pigeonholing someone if we don't actually know them. It's easy to draw a cartoon of someone if you're just seeing them on TV or hearing them on the radio or reading an article by them. But when you're actually sitting face to face with people, there's a very different dynamic. I also grew up in a family where, you know, we're Irish Catholic. My, one of my uncles was a Chicago cop who was, involved with cracking down on protesters in the 60s and while my dad was protesting. And I've had to learn how to deal with my Uncle Jim at it's the cliche, but at Thanksgiving or Christmas dinner. And also, I think in some ways I've become less of a bullheaded person. I think 10 years ago, I wouldn't have been capable of hanging out with someone that, is a Navy SEAL sniper because I would have been standing in utter judgment of them every second of the time we were around each other, or feeling that I needed to spend every moment confronting them for what they've done. And I've learned a tremendous amount from talking, probably I've learned more from talking to people that I disagree with over the past years of working on this than I have with people that I agree with.
That makes sense.
It does, but a lot of times we don't do that. Even in our own human interactions, just on a daily basis. You know, if you're willing to call people your friends, even if you disagree with so much of who they are or what they are, and to actually try to find the humanity in them enough to respect that that's their position, you learn a lot. And so I think part of it is just not being a jerk. And I think part of it, too, is I've been in a lot of these countries, and those guys respect that. They respect the fact that, someone...
You're saying from their side.
From their side, it's like they
you've risked your life with less arms than they're carrying.
Yeah. And so it's in this country right now, the only people that are really forced on a daily basis to think about these wars are, for the most part, military families. And even if it's from a totally different perspective, there is a common experience that you have with people in the military when you're covering these wars. And you also understand some of what those families are going through. I mean, my mom is terrified when I go to Yemen or Somalia. I mean, I really think that I've taken, at least some hours off of her life, maybe days, or she alleges years. But, it's stressful when you know that you're...
When you talked about that first thing you did with Amy when you were in your early 20s, I immediately thought of your mom and dad.
Yeah, I mean, they're very supportive, but they're, they're terribly nervous of it. I mean, I remember Amy told me the story about when she went to East Timor for one of the times, and of course, Amy covered East Timor extensively and was almost killed in East
right.
Timor, that she told her mom that she was going on a vacation to some island, near Australia.
Near Bali.
Exactly, it was Bali, yeah. But she didn't tell her that she had been going to, that she was going to East Timor because she didn't want to terrify her. But I have called my mom from airports before, but I always tell her where I'm going, so, yeah.
Okay. I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with Jeremy Scahill about the revelations in his book, Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. And you can learn more at dirtywars.org and thenation.com. So you've begun to answer this question, Jeremy, but how did this book happen, and what did you hope to accomplish with it?
I've had this idea, the first idea I ever had for a book, and I tried to return to it again after I wrote Blackwater, and it always sort of was in the back of my head. I actually wanted to write a book called The War Party, about the Democratic Party and its foreign policy position. And the first time that I thought about writing this book was just prior to the 2004 election, because I was covering the Kerry campaign and monitoring it very closely, and felt that there's this incredible reality that seems to get very little coverage, and that is that on foreign policy issues, the Democrats and Republicans there's very little difference. But looking at the historical roots of why that's true, and confronting this notion that there actually is a markedly different foreign policy approach under Democrats than there is under Republicans, and I've tried to write that book a number of times, and keep ending up writing a different book in the path. So when I was finished with Blackwater, with the book, I never can quite escape them, but I don't mean that literally. Like,
I know.
Chasing
me.
I'm just saying it's never far from my. It comes up in the. I was on doing a Spanish language interview once, and I was in Spain, and I was interviewed by CNN Espanol, and I said, that the Blackwater story. I said, I breathe Blackwater, I sleep Blackwater, I drink Blackwater, and it's being translated on the air as me drinking sewage. So I was like, I better never say that again. But the point I was making is I can't quite shake them. I had met all of these guys in that community, in the special ops community, and started to know some people who had worked with the CIA. And was looking into the original story I wanted to do was looking at how there were really two wars in Afghanistan. The conventional war where you see the Marines in Helmand Province and there's embedded journalists. But then there was this other sort of war hidden within it, which is a kind of war of attrition, where the U.S. is literally trying to just kill its way to victory.
Now, let me just jump into that because you remind us of the Vietnam War, which was basically waged that way with the body count and so on.
If the Phoenix program too,
if we could kill enough of them that one day everything would flip and we'd have exhausted them and now it would turn around. And now this is obviously very different because there we were killing them by the thousands. Mm. Here it's more pick a list of leaders and if you can kill them.
Right.
I mean, this theory that didn't work when you killed hundreds of thousands now is set to work when you kill a few.
Right. It was based on this sort of bankrupt notion of, counterinsurgency, the coin doctrine that, David Petraeus was the hero that won the Iraq war because of the surge. And I mean, meanwhile, Iraq is in just a bloodbath. There's suicide
as we speak.
And, right, I'm talking about as we speak.
The killings are escalating.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I remember watching the coverage of the hunt for the Tsarnaev kid in the aftermath of the Boston Marathon bombing. And they were there were all these SWAT teams positioned. It was live on the new local news station. And there are all these SWAT teams positioned outside of the house. And turns out that he wasn't there. And then it turns out he didn't have a weapon or anything. But that's for a different story. But watching that coverage and then seeing in sort of microscopic print on the ticker, on the TV, the news ticker, 27 dead in Baghdad cafe blast. And to me, that said a lot about sort of our priorities as a society.
That shot on the screen.
Right. Yeah. And I took a picture of it and I put it on Twitter. It was the most retweeted picture that I've ever had on Twitter. I mean, it was thousands and thousands of people from around the world retweeted. And all I said is, that that this says a lot about the way we sort of, report on the world, that the aftermath, that the sort of afterthought is the Baghdad blast, which has everything to do with what we did to Iraq, its current condition. So you bring up Vietnam, and I think it's really important. The scale of killing in Vietnam far exceeds the scale of killing today. But what we're doing in the process is we are trying to take out specific people on lists. The lists keep growing. The standards for how you get on the list are getting flimsier and flimsier. And in Afghanistan, the U.S. has basically killed its way down the Taliban commanders and the leadership of the Haqqani network to the point where we're basically killing farmers in a valley who are fighting us because we're there. And that's the sort of devastating statement that makes, that when you are killing people just because you're there, you're having to kill people simply because you're there, that you've lost. People talk about what's victory. Like, I don't care how, whatever terms you frame your reason for being there, whatever it is, you've lost.
Now, when you say that, because we killed ourselves down the list, in other words, we targeted, okay, if we can knock off these people who we allege are leaders, and we can knock off a certain number of them in certain critical positions, then we'll break the back of...
That's the theory.
And so what you're saying is we've actually done pretty good at going through that list, and where we're left is now killing... Why does the list keep growing?
Right. Well, because we keep changing who the enemy is, our definition of the enemy. This is the point I'm getting
at. Because it turns out that knocking off those critical ones didn't diminish...
Right.
Anything.
Well, my biggest fear, and I definitely have seen evidence to suggest that this is true, my biggest fear is that even if you destroy what has been known as the Al-Qaeda network, they killed Osama bin Laden. No one really likes Ayman al-Zawahiri, the number two guy. He's just, he's kind of a second-tier character. You've taken out some of the leaders of Al-Qaeda in East Africa and some Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. In the pursuit of killing these people, we've ended up killing a tremendous number of innocent civilians. What I believe is going to start happening is that you're going to have groups of people that have a legitimate score to settle with the United States that are not going to be organized under the jihadist banner of Al-Qaeda, but are going to have their own localized movements. Or it could just be families of people that plot to try to kill a U.S. ambassador somewhere or decide that they want to blow up a train. I think we've created an asymmetric reality that's going to endure for years.
That the innocents that we kill in pursuit of the ones we claim we mean to kill,
their deaths will inspire new people that wouldn't have been inclined to join
a
terrorist
movement. That's the second reason the list never ends and grows.
So let's say, just to put it on a practical level, let's say that you're with a striker brigade in Afghanistan and you've been hunting down people from the Haqqani network and you take over a certain village and you end up chasing these guys back across the border with Pakistan. And you're in this village and you don't leave. You sort of stay. And then there's some incidents that happen where photographs are taken of women in a courtyard and the men then think that you're spying on their women and they start to get mad. And this happens. And then they these guys start to say, we want to get the Americans out of here. They're not Taliban guys. They're not terrorists.
They don't have
They don't have an ideology. As far as they know, these are the Soviets that are here still. I met people in Afghanistan who thought we were the Soviets. They've never heard of the United States, which, I mean, that really tells you something.
I've never heard that before, but it makes sense.
We've got a situation, and it calls for a solution that upholds our domination of the planet. We're gonna make our case, and we're gonna make it well. And if you don't like our logic, you can can it. We'll use impeccable intelligence from any country in the world, as long as we all see eye to eye. And if we don't find quite what we need, we know what to do. Just look into the camera and lie. It's Operation Iraqi Liberation. Tell me, what does that spell? Operation Iraqi Liberation. O-I-L. We'll lie about the missiles and the nuclear research. We'll lie about uranium. We'll build military bases and smile for reporters as we give away bubble gum. We'll lie about Bin Laden, his connections with the Saudis. We'll lie about 9-1-1. We'll lie about the Baathists, their connections to Al-Qaeda, because we know there's none. It's Operation Iraqi Liberation. Tell me, what does that spell? Operation Iraqi Liberation. We'll lie about the North Koreans, and we'll lie about Iran, and don't mention Israel. Keep those nuclear weapons out of this song, and we'll all get together swell. And we'll liberate these people, we'll liberate their money, we'll liberate their soil. We'll liberate their airports, we'll liberate their harbors, and we'll liberate their oil. It's Operation Iraqi Liberation. Tell me, what does that spell? Operation Iraqi Liberation. O-I-L. Operation Iraqi Liberation. Tell me, what does that spell? Operation Iraqi Liberation.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.